From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, it's seen in dozens of countries and has been on the air for over 30 years. What makes PBS's award-winning science series Nova so appealing and so enduring? You'll find out today from Nova's top producer, who's visiting Sacramento. First, the Bush administration is planning changes to the way it runs the national parks. The Department of the Interior, which operates the parks, says these revisions would provide, quote, greater flexibility and clarity, end of quote, for park managers as they balance the competing priorities of protecting the land and keeping that land as open as possible to visitor enjoyment. But critics say the administration's plans would tilt the balance in favor of recreation. The Sierra Club, for one, says the draft new policies would, quote, diminish park protection and boost commercialism, end of quote. You'll hear a variety of opinions on this today. Later in the show, you'll hear from the recent former head of the National Parks. He's now a law professor in Sacramento. You'll also hear from officials of the Sierra Club and a leading off-road motorized recreation group. Let's start with Pia Lopez. She's an editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. Last month, she wrote critically of the planned changes to the national parks. She's in our studio. Pia Lopez, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you.
Well, I tried to keep up with these matters, but when I read your editorial last month, I went, oh, I didn't know about this. Do many people know about this?
Probably not. The process began, for the public at least, in August of last year when a draft was leaked to the public. The Department of the Interior had been working on a draft. That was leaked. It caused immediate public outrage, and the department then said that this was a devil's advocate draft. Then the process moved forward, and another draft was released October 18th. So that's what the public is seeing now, and that was released for public comment, a 90-day comment period.
Well, the point here is to revise the management policies for the national parks. What do you not like in what you've seen?
Well, let me go back to the beginning. The national park system as a system begins in 1916 with what they call the 1916 Organic Act, which says that the purpose of the national park system is to preserve the parks unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. And there's always been some conflict over this. And our point of view is that at a time when population is growing and there are more and more pressures on the park, that core mission to preserve the parks unimpaired remains key.
And what are you seeing in the in these proposals that would undermine the natural qualities of the parks?
Well, there's fuzziness. First of all, the Park Service continues to say that when there's a conflict between use and conservation, that preservation should be predominant, but they've taken that phrase out of the management policies. Then there are examples like, and it might sound innocuous, that it defines appropriate uses as uses that were historically in the park. Well, in Sequoia Kings Canyon, logging was historically in the park. In the Santa Monica Mountains, development was rampant in the park. In Mojave National Preserve, there used to be motorcycle races. So where do you draw the line? I mean, to the ordinary person, many of these changes might seem innocent and innocuous, but at every step, they move more towards permissibility of uses rather than protection of the existing resources.
Pia Lopez is an editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. She recently wrote an editorial about the proposed changes to national parks management policies. Joining us now on the phone is Scott Gediman, who's a National Park Service spokesperson. He's based at Yosemite. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Could you put this in context for us? How big a deal is this this project at the National Parks to re-examine management policies?
Well, it's a big deal in the sense that the management policies have not been revised since 2001, so they're 5 years. And although, as Pia said, we are guided by the Organic Act, there's 390 units of the national park system, and of course each unit is different. And so here in Yosemite National Park, for example, we've asked park visitors and the employees here to provide comments. The comment period has ended for this draft management policy, but we don't see an overwhelming shift in the way we'll manage Yosemite National Park as a result of these management policies. Again, as Pia said, there has been a lot of discussion about this, but basically right now they're in the steps of looking at the 50,000 public comments and reviewing them and coming out with a draft later in the year. But we don't see a fundamental shift in any way in the way we continue to manage Yosemite National Park.
Mm. You said the management policies were last revised in 2001. Is this current revision part of a scheduled re-examination of policies that happens every few years?
It does. It's very similar to the park's general management plan. There's no set schedule, but what's very interesting is that in Yosemite, for example, the last general management plan, the overall plan for managing the park, was last done in 1980. So it's over 20 years that we've done one of these, and other parks have done them every few years. And so this is just something that, as the park system continues to grow and diversify, this is a periodic look at the management policies, refining them and basically looking at ways that they could be more applicable and useful to park managers.
Mm. You said 50,000 public comments?
Yes.
Is that at Yosemite or nationwide?
No, that's nationwide, and that all went to our Washington office. And then what will happen is a group of career National Park Service professionals will look at them, get together, and then on April 25th, a revised draft will be given to the National Leadership Council, which is a lot of the senior leadership of the National Park Service, and the two groups will basically get together, the National Park Service heads and the National Leadership Council. They'll review the document, and we're looking at a draft out in mid-July.
Is it your sense that this is controversial? Could you put this 50,000 public comments in context? How does that compare to other national parks issues where something big is going on and the public is asked to weigh in?
Well, I think that I think that people are very concerned about it. What I've always found here is a good example. Here in Yosemite National Park, our biggest plan lately was the Yosemite Valley Plan, which was released in 2000, and we got approximately 15,000 public comments on that, and that's just on one plan for one part of one national park. And I think what this says is that Americans care deeply about their national parks, and I think the fact that a lot of people are putting public comments in is actually a good thing, because as part of our planning process under NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, we are mandated to incorporate the public's comments. And so I think this 50,000 is a good indication about how deeply Americans care about their national parks. And so I find it very encouraging, and the same thing, the 15,000 comments that we have here, I find it very encouraging, because people not only care about their parks, but want their opinions to be heard and want it to be part of how we manage not only the National Park Service, but individual park units as well.
Mm. Scott Gedeman is a National Park Service spokesperson at Yosemite. Pia, it looked like you had something on your mind.
Well, if Scott believes that this will not change his management of Yosemite very much, the question then becomes, what are current policies not providing that we need to alter? I mean, if it really is not going to do that much, why do we need to do it at all? Why do we need a rewrite at this time? And why a total rewrite, not just a couple of amendments? And the previous rewrite was done in 2001. That's only 5 years away. There are only 8 new areas that have been added to the park since 2000. The previous rewrite was 1988. In the entire history of the park system, there have only been 13 rewrites. It's usually about once every decade. So the big question is, why are we doing this? Most of the comments that have come in have said, we don't need this rewrite, abandon it.
Mm. Scott, as you answer that, could you also tell us, clarify perhaps, was the 2001 rewrite done at least in part as part of the Clinton administration?
Well, it was. It was started when these things go out, they have to be, it's not just something that's done very quickly. We have, again, through NEPA, we have to have what we call the notice of intent, where we put out that we're planning on doing this, and then we release drafts, and then we have a public comment period, and then we have time to analyze the comments. And so I don't know exactly when the 2001 rewrite started, but I do imagine it would have been part of the Clinton administration. And to get to get back to the comment, I think what's interesting is that a good example here in Yosemite National Park, we have almost 95% of the park is designated wilderness. And so any kind of development or any kind of impairment to the wilderness simply is not going to happen. And as far as some of the historical uses, yes, logging was a part of Sequoia, as it was here in some of these other activities. But I think that as individual park managers, the superintendents that run most of the national parks, I don't think that this is opening the door to bring back any of those uses that hadn't been used in the past. And I don't think that the off-roading, for example, or a lot of these things overall in the entire United States, about 85% of all the national parks, for example, are designated federal wilderness. And this is very strict guidelines, and so nothing is going to override that. And so I think it's one of those things that I certainly don't want to belittle this or make it sound like it won't have an effect, but I think that the perception that this is going to cause overall changes in the management of national parks may be a little bit misguided in that sense. Mm.
Then why do we need the rewrite at all?
Well,
not amend it?
Well, I think that the rewrite is just something that the folks from the Department of Interior feel it's a time to look at them, and you know, I think that's okay. I think the fact that that there were so many public comments, as I said before, was encouraging, and the public comments by law have to be incorporated into the final draft, and I know this from not working on this, but in working on several major plans during my time here in Yosemite. And so I think that, you know, you could look at it that the new plan and the revision is going to incorporate the way the public wants their park managed, and I think that's a good thing, because the Organic Act, as you mentioned, with basically preserving, protecting the park, and providing for the enjoyment of the people, I don't think we can minimize that at all. That for the you know, 3.5 million visitors to Yosemite, their experience is very important.
Okay. Scott mentioned the Department of the Interior. A good time to bring in our next guest, who's Craig Manson, professor at McGeorge School of Law and recent former Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks in the U.S. Department of the Interior. His duties included overseeing the National Park Service. He joins us by phone. Craig Manson, welcome back to Insight.
Good afternoon, Jeff.
This proposed revision of the management policies at the national parks, I guess this started when you were still in Washington. Was this part of a scheduled review and it was circled in everyone's calendar that it needed to happen? Or was a decision made at either political or a civil service level that this needed to happen?
Well, it was made at both the political and civil service levels. I think that Scott's description of how that happened was completely accurate. The previous rewrite in the Clinton administration actually began in 1996 and was completed in 2001. And just as this rewrite won't be completed until well into 2007, it takes that length of time to get something done.
Mm. What's your position as someone who used to work at the Department of the Interior, but now who's looking from the outside, but who I guess understands what's going on and who's doing what? What's your position on these proposed revised management changes?
Well, the thing to keep in mind is that regardless of what happens in the management policies document, the overriding control of the national parks is set forth in the Organic Act, as Pia Lopez said, and that provides for a standard of impairment. So whatever historic uses or new uses might be suggested for the national parks, they must be uses that leave the parks unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. That's the boundary line that cannot be crossed. So to the extent that management policies provide a framework or a guidance document for park superintendents in managing those uses, the Organic Act provides an absolute boundary that cannot be crossed.
Is there any pressure in Washington within the administration to at least push against that boundary?
Well, I don't know that there's pressure to push against the boundary. I think the feeling is and has been that we need some guidance for park managers instead of simply regarding every everything as potential impairment, we need a way to sort out these uses and figure out which uses are appropriate and which uses are not appropriate.
Yes.
The management policies don't say, for example, that logging is an appropriate use or that something else is an inappropriate use. Instead, the management policies draft sets out a way of analyzing these things that park managers can use.
Yes.
And the other thing that's important to understand about this management policies exercise is that it is a process, as Scott indicated. There's no guarantee whatsoever that the current draft will be adopted by the Park Service because the public comments do have to be incorporated by law, and the Park Service has to analyze those and respond to each substantive comment, each unique substantive comment.
Mm-hmm. Pia, quick response before we take a break.
Well, the issue here is about how impairment is defined, because in that original draft that was leaked in August, unimpaired was changed to mean only irreversible damage, which would mean that you could have almost anything non-permanent. You could have billboards, you could have cell towers, you could have commercial naming rights on buildings and trails, you could have low-flying tour flights, you could have all kinds of things. Now, some of that language has been fuzzed up in the October draft that we're now looking at, but the issue is, what does unimpaired mean?
Okay. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more opinions of the proposed changes to how the national parks are run. I'll speak with officials from the Sierra Club and the Blue Ribbon Coalition. And later, the top producer of PBS's science series, Nova. She's visiting Sacramento. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can hear today's show and recent archive programs on the web at capradio.org/insight. That's also the place you can sign up for the Insight podcast. The Bush administration is planning changes to the way it runs the national parks. It says the goal is to help park managers as they balance the competing priorities of protecting the land and keeping that land as open as possible to visitor enjoyment. But critics say the administration's plans would tilt the balance in favor of recreation. My guests you've already met are Pia Lopez, editorial writer at the Sacramento Bee. She recently wrote an editorial about the proposed changes to national parks management policies. On the phone, Scott Gedeman, who's a National Park Service spokesperson at Yosemite, and Craig Manson of McGeorge School of Law. He's a recent former Assistant Secretary for Fish and Wildlife and Parks at the U.S. Department of the Interior. We're going to hear in this section also from officials at two groups with a great deal of interest in how the national parks are run. Let's start with the Sierra Club. Joining us is Carl Zakella, who's the Sierra Club's Regional Staff Director for California, Hawaii, and Nevada. Carl, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
I saw a Sierra Club press release on this a couple of months ago. The Sierra Club didn't seem very impressed. What are the Sierra Club's objections to these draft revised management policies at the parks?
Well, I think Pia's hit on a number of them and very well. The foremost question is, why are we doing this? What is the need to do it? Very few parks have been added to the system. The last rewrite was in 2001. They're usually done every 10 years. This is a political rewrite, in our opinion. It's not a rewrite of need to protect the resources. I've been looking at congressional testimony on this subject. One very interesting piece by a guy named Don Castleberry, who I know very well from my days as a Midwest director of the Sierra Club, who is testifying on behalf of Coalition of National Park Service retirees. And Don, who ran national parks for many years, has a very scathing take on this because, as Pia said, it changes the very fundamental protection mandate for the national parks. The LEATS language that was very clear replaces it with vague language. It opens the door to eliminating the treatment of clean air issues in national parks of great seriousness, something that's really concerned Senator Dianne Feinstein in her comments to the National Park Service. I think you have to realize that some of our national parks, like Sequoia Kings Canyon, are really polluted because of air pollution in our state. There were 315 unhealthful ozone pollution days in Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park in 2004, and EPA designated the park a non-attainment area. These standards would make it more difficult to help protect the airsheds of national parks, which by law are supposed to be Class 1 airsheds, unimpaired. It would open the door to more coal-fired power plants affecting national parks in other parts of the country, like the Shenandoah and the Great Basin, where visibility has been a big issue. Another problem that I haven't heard anybody talk about is this mandate in these rules that the Park Service shall, coordinate rather than cooperate with local interests around national park management. And having worked in parts of the country where we had local interests that all they want to do is run jet skis and snowmobiles into national parks like Voyageurs National Park or Isle Royale National Park, which are in Minnesota and Michigan respectively, mm-hmm. right up on the Canadian border. These are some really crown jewels of the national parks. We can talk about Yosemite not being impacted because it's 95% wilderness. But many of these national parks were created to protect them from rapacious local interests.
Yeah. Carl, you've covered a lot of things here. Can you help me connect some dots here? How would these draft management policy changes make air quality worse in national parks?
Well, the proposed change demotes the standard for clear skies from an essential component of the parks to what's called an associated characteristic. The definition of a national condition has also been altered to allow man-made impacts. These changes appear to us to be an accommodation for air pollution in the parks, and also appear to Senator Feinstein to be exactly that also. And she wrote so as such to Park Service Director Fran Minella, and her letter was February 16th of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one really big concern of mine, especially.
Okay.
Given the Central Valley air pollution problems, Sierra Club and other organizations have been suing to improve air quality in the valley. We've been fighting to do this. And one of the big reasons is you can't even get away from it in the national park.
Scott Gedeman, do you have any comments on what Carl was just saying about air quality?
Well, I think, Sequoia Kings Canyon, he is correct in what he was saying, and we do have some air quality issues here in Yosemite National Park. But you know, the difference here versus parks, a lot like Mammoth Cave and Kentucky or Great Smoky Mountains, is that a lot of the issues and problems that we have are by factors outside of the park, either by, power plants or some people think that that pesticides in the Central Valley, for example, have something to do with it. And there are certain components of it that we as the National Park Service don't have any control over. And so those are issues that, of course, air quality, just like everything, noise is a very valuable component of a national park, but there's only so much we can do.
I'm sorry, but I have to disagree, and it's been a function of the parks and a role of park superintendents forever in this country to object to management outside of their boundaries that is impacting their resources. And in fact, in Senator Feinstein's letter says, most pollution affecting national parks comes from sources outside park boundaries, and park officials must retain oversight over and authority to object against permits for major air pollution sources. We've had similar incidences about mining outside of Yellowstone, where National Park Service personnel, management staff have been, vocal and objecting to these management policies, and this makes it more difficult for them to do so.
Let's see what Craig Manson has to say. Craig?
Well, there's nothing in the draft. Two things. First, there's nothing in the draft management policies that keeps a park manager from voicing objections to management outside park boundaries that will impact the parks at all. Second, it is a process, as I said, and Senator Feinstein's letter is one of those comments that will be taken into the process by the Park Service and incorporated into their final draft.
Carl, earlier you said that this proposed these proposed changes were, quote, a political rewrite. Could you back that up? Why do you say that?
Well, just because of the fact that it's been only 5 years since the rules have been rewritten. And also it fits into a pattern that we've seen repeatedly from the Department of the Interior, Secretary Norton, the Forest Service, where there's been a relentless effort to undermine rules that were established during the Clinton administration, such as the Roadless Area Initiative, for example, such as the federal clean air statutes through EPA that have been relentlessly weakened, that even the Republican-controlled Senate wouldn't allow out of the Senate Environment Committee, the so-called Clear Skies rules. It's just been one thing after another from this administration, and the weight of the scales against environmental protection in their policies has been overwhelmingly opposed.
Craig Manson, you were part of the administration. Could you respond, please?
Well, you know, there's a reason that there are elections in this country, and that's because people want to see things changed, and that includes things that relate to the management of our natural resources. And obviously, things will change when there are elections, and that's what's happened here. Things have changed, and some of those things are not to the liking of some people, and they're to the liking of other folks.
Well, I refuse. Fundamentally,
what has not changed is the commitment to keep the parks unimpaired for future generations. There's never been any question about the current administration's commitment to that. There never was when I was there, and there's nothing in these draft management policies that questions that whatsoever. And again, it's a process. And I think we have to wait and see what they propose at the end of the public comment process before it's legitimate to say what the administration would or would not do.
Well, I think part of the process to influence that is speaking out against these changes now, which we are doing. And I refuse to believe that the American people voted for less protection for national parks, more arsenic in their drinking water, more air pollution. Those weren't things that the American people thought they were voting on. And to suggest that the election is the reason that we're having weakening changes here, I think, is really specious.
Hey, Carl,
well, of course, I dispute that there's been any weakening of standards. I said that there have been changes in the way we go about managing our natural resources. That doesn't mean that we weaken standards whatsoever. The science will show that the air is cleaner than it was 4 years ago, that natural resources are better off than they were 4 years ago, and that on the whole, the protection of the parks is much better than it was 4 years ago as well.
With respect, we're moving into a different topic here. It would be a terrific topic for a whole program, but we're moving off of where we are. Carl, I wanted to pick up on another thing you said.
Mm-hmm.
You said that there would be a move here with these new policies to coordinate with rather than cooperate with local interests in the parks. Why is that a problem?
Well, it's a problem in rural areas where you've had, and this started back when Gingrich Congress was elected, and their efforts to do this were rejected, by the way, but they were trying to push some national parks to be managed by local governments. And this was an idea that, of course, the American people did not accept, fought against. And this language is a step, again, in that direction. There are local bodies that are advisory to the national parks in places like International Falls, Minnesota. Redwood National Park has one that, by and large, in many places operate very well, but in some places are really controlled by local interests that are not friendly to the park, not interested in park protection, want motorized access throughout the park, intrusive motorized access such as jet skis and snowmobiles, these sorts of things. And having them sort of giving, this gives them a lot more authority than they would normally have under the present rules. And it is a real threat to the national parks in many places.
Okay. Our next guest is Don Amador, who's a Blue Ribbon Coalition spokesperson. The Blue Ribbon Coalition works to, among other things, to protect access to motorized recreation on public lands. Don, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Jeffrey, good to be here.
What does the Blue Ribbon Coalition think about these proposed changes?
Well, you know, the main focus of our comments, and first let me say, you know, Blue Ribbon supports the dual mission of the Park Service as outlined in the Organic Act. Our main concern was that, as Ben mentioned, the 2001 management policies from the Clinton administrations, I think, focused too sharply on protecting park resources and values while ignoring the other part of the Organic Act, which talks about providing for use and enjoyment of visitors. And there's a lot of national parks, Death Valley, Joshua Tree, and others, that have legitimate motorized access management prescriptions that are valid and historic. And it was our concern that under the Clinton rule that the Park Service would, their first option when a conflict or use issue came up was to close. And I think that this rewrite will help get us back, or at least we're hoping get us back to a balance where you protect resources while still recognizing that public access has an important element to play. Anyway, we just feel that it's important to get back to a balance.
Was the Blue Ribbon Coalition involved in any way in drafting these policies, or are you solely commenting on them?
No, we weren't involved in actually rewriting these things. We did submit comments in January for these policies, and we're hoping that we can get back to a balance of use.
Okay.
I mean, Redwood National Park was mentioned here earlier, and, you know, it's our concern. We would like to see local involvement and coordination with local groups. I mean, Redwood National Park under the Clinton administration closed historic motorized access for surf fishing. In fact, in their management plan that was done in the late 90s, the Park Service actually acknowledged that they were going to put the surf fishermen out of business. And we just feel decisions like that are inappropriate, and we'd like to see more coordination with local interest groups.
Pia Lopez, your comments?
The issue of national interest versus local interest is as basic to this debate as the issue of how you keep the parks unimpaired. In 1918, the first management policy said that the national interest must dictate all decisions affecting public or private enterprise in the parks. The Bush changes, where you would coordinate more with local groups, would be a major change, and, you know, people can say whether or not they like that. I wouldn't like it. I think we should stick with the 1918 version.
Okay. Carl?
Yes.
Kelly, your thoughts on what Don Amador was saying?
Well, I think that Pia is exactly right. The national parks in Redwood National Park, a park I'm intimately familiar with, it's the example, I think, of belonging to not just the people lucky enough to live next to it, who may be, you know, 20 people a year are surf fishermen up there, whatever the number is, it's quite small, to the many thousands of people who are visiting. It belongs as much to the plumber in Los Angeles as it does to the surf fishermen in McKinleyville. And it seems to me that that is the nut of this whole thing. It's what we leave to future generations, how unimpaired it is, the standard that protection should come first, and that enjoyment comes from protection, not flows from impacts to make it every single use that people might want to do, including trucks on the beach to go surf fishing, as acceptable.
We are going to have to wrap this up fairly soon with final thoughts from everyone. But Don Amador, I'll give you a chance to respond to Carl and Pia.
Well, I mean, the administration, not only this one, but the Clinton administration, talked a lot about working with local interest groups and serving local parties. And we just feel that working with local groups is important, as well as, you know, we know that it belongs to everybody, but there needs to be cooperation, and that's what we're supporting.
Okay. Final thoughts from everyone. Let's start with you, Pia Lopez of the Bee.
Well, as other people have mentioned, the last rewrite process took 6 years. It began in 1994, and the final result was 2001. This one has been rushed. It's been largely hidden from the public. The first draft really was released publicly October 18th. The 90-day comment period has ended. Why is there a rush on this? Why is this necessary? No one has presented any convincing argument as to why we need to change the policies. The park superintendents and most employees have, for the most part, been left out of this. They've been pretty intimidated into silence, and it's been the retired Park Service employees who have spoken up against it.
Okay. Craig Manson?
Well, Park Service employees have played a tremendous role in getting these policies to the point that they're at now, and they'll continue to play a role. I'm certain about that. The important thing, again, is that it is a process and the public is involved. the Park Service by law will take into account what the public says about these things, and it's important to understand that the Park Service does have two aspects that they have to deal with under the Organic Act, and both of those things are equally important. And it may be argued that in some sense protection comes from enjoyment, because if people aren't in the parks, then they lose interest in the parks, and then we don't have anything, we don't have a constituency that's interested in protecting parks.
Okay, thank you. Don Amador?
Well, I agree with Craig. I mean, the purpose of the Organic Act with the Park Service was not only to protect resources, but to get people out and enjoy them. And if people can't get out and enjoy them, and of course we advocate in a responsible manner, then, you know, what's the purpose of having the park?
Thank you. Carl Zakella, your final thoughts?
Sure. I mean, millions of people visit the national parks and enjoy them every year. The overwhelming majority of them don't like these changes. They want more protection for the parks, not less. Fewer motors in the parks, not more. The American people treasure their national parks. And I think PIA really hit the nail on the head. It's unnecessary. It's not needed. And it isn't going to help. And the fact that 100 Park Service employees helped draft this thing does not mean that the Park Service employees were represented throughout. Mm-hmm. I think that, as Don Castleberry pointed out in his comments to Congress, it's window dressing. When, you know, he wonders how many people in the Park Service think these changes are even needed, and speaking out as a retired Park Service professional of many years standing. So I think that it's clearly a political thing that's been occurring. It's not needed. It's not good for the parks. They ought to just pull them back.
Okay. Thank you. And Scott Gedeman, earlier you said that the, as Craig Manson said as well, that the Park Service is, quote, mandated to include public comments. How exactly does that work? How do we know that public comments are included, regardless of what those comments are, in the final document?
When the final draft comes out, this plan, as any other plan, has to have the response to comments. And what happens is all the comments are read thoroughly, and then they're put in. They're basically put into categories. And as Judge Manson said, they have to be substantively addressed. And it is a separate binder that comes out with the plan, the response to comments, and it has to be incorporated into the final plan. And so I feel that the 50,000 comments that people sent in, and also we were encouraged, myself not only as the park spokesman but as a National Park Service employee, was encouraged by park management to send in comments. And so I think that there's a lot more than 100 National Park Service people that are commenting. And so I think that the basic tenets of the protection and the enjoyment are there, and I'm looking forward to the draft, and I feel that it will reflect all of these comments. It has to, and it's a process, and I'm looking forward to seeing the draft later in the spring.
Excellent. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today about this complicated topic. That's Don Amador, Blue Ribbon Coalition spokesperson on the phone. Also on the phone, Carl Zakella of the Sierra Club, Craig Manson of McGeorge School of Law and recently formerly of the Department of the Interior in Washington, Scott Gedeman from the National Park Service in Yosemite, and in our studio, Pia Lopez of the Sacramento Bee. Thanks again, all of you.
You bet.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, the top producer of PBS's long-running and highly acclaimed science series, Nova. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Infrastructure is the big topic now at the Capitol, where there are several proposals for huge infrastructure bonds. Tomorrow in Insight, you'll hear several of the Capitol's top players explain what they think should be funded and by how much. And Friday on Insight, NPR's award-winning legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, she's coming to town this weekend. You'll find more information on recent and future insights and on our website, capradio.org/insight. Also, a reminder, the excellent series of reports from KXJZ News on bonds wraps up tomorrow morning on Morning Edition. The famous public television science series NOVA recently celebrated 30 years on the air. NOVA gives in-depth treatment to sometimes complicated topics, and that commitment to serious reporting has yielded dozens of awards over the years, including the top awards in TV and in broadcast journalism. All the seriousness doesn't appear to have hurt NOVA's ratings. In fact, it's one of public TV's signature programs. The Sacramento PBS station KVIE says NOVA is often its highest-rated program. NOVA's senior executive producer is in Sacramento today. She's Paula Apsel. She started working for NOVA in its earliest days in 1975. She's run the program since 1984. Paula Apsel, welcome to Insight.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
How many people watch NOVA?
About 6 million people a week watch, and so that's quite a few people, and we feel a sense of the responsibility of having so many people as our loyal viewers.
It sounds like a lot. There are a lot of commercial network programs that would be happy to get 6 million viewers. How do you manage to attract 6 million people to watch a program that is in-depth, relatively long compared to a lot of examinations of science topics on commercial TV? How do you get 6 million people every week to tune in?
Well, you know, when NOVA first began, or actually before it began, people, network executives, did not believe that anybody would watch science on television. They thought that it was just going to be a bunch of kind of white-coated nerds or brilliant psychopaths running around, and they thought the material would be much too difficult and the concepts would be too hard, and they thought no one would watch. And really, that was the truth in public television as well as in the networks. Walter Cronkite himself had tried to start a science series on CBS called Universe. They did a couple of seasons, but CBS would never continue with it, and that was to the August Cronkite they had to turn down. So networks, they just didn't have faith in it. But there was a belief in public television that if they put on a science program, people would watch it. And I think that's because, first of all, very simply, people are really fascinated by science. They really are. And they want to watch programs that tell them more about the natural world. But I also think that it relates in a way to how the program is done. I don't think you can do science on television any way. I think if you do science on television and you just have it be a kind of a collection of facts, or if you use a lot of jargon, people really aren't going to like it, or you talk down to people or patronize them or anything like that, or sort of talk above their heads. What we try to do on NOVA, which I think is really the formula that really works, is we have a belief that science is a story. Story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, that it's some kind of mystery to be solved, an obstacle to be overcome, a conflict to be resolved, and that gives the program a really strong dramatic arc. We also like to make programs that have strong characters and have visuals that are very different from what people have seen before.
So when you talk about the beginning, middle, and end, you're talking about the scientific method itself, how the scientists mm-hmm. approached the problem and how they worked on it and how they solved it. That's the story.
Absolutely. And again, it's that science is not just a collection of facts. It's a process. And by following that process, people will be told a story that they'll find irresistible.
In the last 31 years, TV has changed in every way one could imagine. Mm-hmm. Have you come under pressure to make NOVA zippier, sexier, cooler, whatever?
Yes, that's a simple answer. But I wouldn't necessarily say that it's necessarily under pressure. As new technologies become available, for example, 3D animation and new ways of editing and new fashions and new styles of presenting material, we have really wanted to try out new things. You know, if I sort of have an expression, you have to change or you die. And so I think that we've taken advantage of new opportunities and to make the program better. And it's not so much pressure. Yeah, everybody has pressure with ratings. And I would say probably we at public broadcasting have less pressure than others, but it doesn't mean we don't have any pressure. After all, you do make the programs because you want people to watch them. I don't want my mother to be the only person that's watching them, although I really like when she does watch it. But so you want to keep the program have a contemporary look. So yes, we certainly have made changes.
PBS and its member stations get a lot of money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is chartered by the government mm-hmm. and is ultimately funded by the mm-hmm. government, although there's, in theory, a buffer zone between the government and public broadcasting. How does Nova tackle topics that are scientific topics that are politically controversial? I'm thinking, of course, of evolution and global warming. Well, do you feel like those have to be treated even more carefully than other scientific topics?
I think that on all our programs, we have to be careful. I think if you make a mistake, if you're not completely accurate, you really kind of weaken your case. And so we have a certain standard for accuracy. We have certain procedures to guarantee accuracy. And we do them for each and every program, whether the topic is a really important, earth-shattering one or whether it's a lighter topic. So so then it's not that difficult for us when we do programs that do, and so many, all of our programs in the biological sciences touch in some way on evolution. In fact, we made a series, an 8-part series in 2001 on evolution. We got plenty of criticism, but we didn't get any pressure. I have to say that I have really never come under pressure either from PBS or from CPB or from the corporate underwriters that support NOVA to do anything different from the way that we normally do it. And I think that partly is because we've really earned the reputation for being very careful and very accurate, so we're not a very easy target.
My guest is Paula Apsell, senior executive producer of the PBS science series NOVA. Has anyone ever pitched you a topic that you thought was very interesting and important, but was just too complicated to tell, even in 60 minutes or within the constraints of TV, and you just said, you know what, we can't do this?
You know, there are a lot of topics within science and technology that are very complicated, and that when you first hear about them or think about them, it's really hard to bend your mind around them. The thing about it is that a creative director, creative filmmaker, really ought to be able to take a very difficult topic and figure out some way to tell the story. And that was the case. A physicist named Brian Green wrote a book called The Elegant Universe about string theory. And man, string theory is really, really abstract. I mean, it's nothing that people would have ever come across in their daily lives. And I read the book and I really loved it. And I met Brian and I saw what an engaging character he was. But it really gave you Excedrin headache number 10 to really think about that. But ultimately, we did do a 3-part series called The Elegant Universe. It was one of our most highly rated miniseries that we've ever done. It sold over 100,000 copies in DVD. So people really liked it. So I think sometimes when you have a topic that you know is really right, you just have to think about it for a while and figure out there is a way to tell a story about almost everything.
Who in general makes a better NOVA filmmaker, a scientist who learns how to make films or a filmmaker who learns about science?
For the most part, I can't really answer that question because I haven't worked with all that many scientists who've learned how to make films. Most scientists who are really good scientists kind of stay in the lab. And some of them, like Brian himself, who is a practicing physicist and a very good one, he had a lot of ideas. And one of the reasons that I loved his book so much is that he had so many visual metaphors for highly abstract ideas. So the recipe for the programs themselves actually emerged pretty much right out of Brian's book. Mm. So there are some scientists who are very visually talented. And remember that science is a lot. What scientists are trying to do is pretty much in many ways the same way as what we're trying to do. They're trying to see what is really invisible. They're trying to figure out a way to do that. So in one way, that's why science so much lends itself to the visual medium.
You've worked on NOVA for over 30 years. How do you keep the job interesting?
It's fantastically interesting because we have, you know, every week we have a different program on the air. So every week there's a different subject to master. There's something to really new to really think about, to figure out. It's just filled with problem solving. And science, in the years that I've been working on NOVA, has just become so much more vibrant. Listen, we had the computer revolution. We had the revolution in biology. I mean, I've reported and been a journalist through many of the most exciting science developments ever. And so there's no way it can get boring.
And in the seconds that remain, I must ask, does NOVA stand for anything? It's capitalized.
There's some controversy over whether it's capitalized. Some people capitalize it. I do. Others really don't. But it does have to do with stars.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Paula Apsel. It was a real pleasure meeting you, and welcome to Sacramento.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's Paula Apsel, Senior Executive Producer of the PBS Science Series, NOVA. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's Associate Producer, Sarah Garut. The engineer, John Florek. Insight's Technical Director is Mark Jones, who also directed today's program. Insight's Senior Producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. Infrastructure is the big topic now at the Capitol, where there are several proposals for huge infrastructure bonds. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Next time in Insight, you'll hear several of the Capitol's top players explain what they think should be funded and by how much. Also, a former head of the Black Panther Party on what she calls New Age racism. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.